This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. This week on the program, we bring you a forum to ask the question, should we have a universal basic income in the U.S.? A UBI refers to the disbursing of an amount of income to all members within a society, no strings attached, with the intention of curbing poverty and increasing economic freedom. While limited tests or modified UBI systems have been attempted across the world, an unqualified universal basic income has never been adopted, but the policy has gained proponents ranging from economists to politicians to revolutionaries. Just a few months ago, discussion of a universal basic income was relegated to Andrew Yang's presidential campaign. Now the policy tool has gained renewed relevance in light of the cascading economic impacts of the coronavirus pandemic. While the U.S. has already passed a $1,200 per person stimulus, other countries are adopting more robust and continuous relief efforts. Spain, an epicenter of COVID-19, is currently working on plans to institute a UBI. Canada is enrolling unemployed workers and those making less than $12,000 a year in a $2,000 per month relief program for up to 4 months. Democratic members of Congress, such as Representative Tulsi Gabbard, Ro Khanna, and Tim Ryan, have pushed to implement similar programs in the U.S. But what will be included in future federal relief packages is still being worked out. Getting into the strengths and weaknesses of universal basic income are Rudy Van Arnhem, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Utah, Gina Cornea, Executive Director of Utahns Against Hunger, and Stephen Bannister, Associate Professor of Economics at the U. Moderating the discussion is Brad Williams, Director of the Entrepreneurship Program at the David Eccles School of Business. This discussion was recorded on February 27, 2019. Here is Brad Williams.
Just by way of very high-level introduction, I'm curious for my own interest, how many here are familiar with the concept of universal basic income? Great. And for how many of you is this a brand new topic? Okay, thanks for being honest. That's great. So the concept of a generous universal payment to citizens of a country is actually not a brand new concept. It's in the United States alone, discussion of some form of this type of universal basic income was discussed as far back as Thomas Paine. Martin Luther King actually spoke in favor of this topic. Maybe one of you knows the quote, but essentially one of the best ways to remove poverty is to remove poverty by providing income to people. In either 1971 or 1972, during the Nixon administration, the United States House of Representatives actually passed a bill to this end, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure the exact process and fate, but perhaps one of us, one of you here could expound on that. And then currently, it's become a much more prevalent issue in terms of discussion in public policy with commentators on both sides of the issue, but primarily a lot of support, I think it's fair to say, quite a bit of support among technologists in Silicon Valley executives, and also noteworthy CEOs from Warren Buffett to Mark Zuckerberg have spoken in favor of some type of this universal basic income. There are current initiatives around the world to test various forms of universal basic income. Some of those include the Netherlands, Kenya, India, Switzerland, Finland, France, and others. So it's not just sort of small, obscure, out-of-the-way places. These are names we've heard of. And the intellectual debate around this concept of a guaranteed income has garnered support among intellectuals across the political and ideological divide. Others obviously consider UBI to be a solution in search of a problem, so we'll be able to discuss this today. But in particular, and so often this sort of guaranteed payment seems to register for a lot of people as something in the far left and socialist camp, but I actually found some thought leaders on the conservative side of the spectrum, namely at the American Enterprise Institute. Charles Murray is actually in favor of replacing the entire welfare state with a guaranteed income of some sort, so he's in favor of providing payments to people and then letting them make the decisions about how they spend that at their own discretion. Also within the American Enterprise Institute, again on the far right here, or I should say, I don't mean that disparagingly, I mean that on the conservative side of things, Arthur Brooks, another intellectual at the AEI, he actually looks at it as, he argues there is an intrinsic reward for people to work, and that just happier people tend to be those meaningfully engaged in work. And he calls himself, when it comes to the UBI debate, the, and I quote, the skunk at the garden party, and he doesn't believe in paying people just to breed. So a lot of emotions running, as well as sort of reasonable arguments from both sides. But without further ado, I think what we'd like to do, perhaps we've got a list of questions here that we're kind of gonna go through, and then we're happy to, do you want us to go through some of the, just the panel discussion first, and then we'll do some Q&A at the end? Is that the best format? Great, so we'll do this. So. Anyway, so there are a lot of debates as to how this might take shape and whether it's a good or a bad thing overall. But maybe to start, in fact, I will say I want to start focusing on the problem, and discussion of this problem, as I mentioned, has crept up a lot among Silicon Valley elites, and in part because one of the arguments as justifying a need for a solution like this has been raised more prominently recently by a CEO of the American Venture Institute, Andrew Yang, I believe. Anyway, Andrew is son of two immigrants who are very, very accomplished, well-educated. He himself went to Brown and got a law degree from Columbia, has been an entrepreneur, and decided that he wanted to try and effect change and it sort of restore, help people find meaningful work because of this intrinsic value that we've heard people discuss about work. And so he actually wrote a book. He saw that there were a number of people sort of becoming, I'll use the term we might be familiar with from socialism, the alienation of people from meaningful work. And so he started, I believe it was the American Venture Institute, to help people find meaningful work, and he's created with that organization about 3,000 jobs. But in the process of working on this, he found that some of the smartest engineers in Silicon Valley and around the world are actually working feverishly because of the economic incentive involved to create technology and speed up the pace of automation of a lot of jobs. And so what he's saying is, I believe he said from 2000 to 2010, there's something like 4 million jobs in manufacturing were outsourced to other countries in the United States. But there's also a marked decline in industries and spaces that employ millions upon millions of Americans today that are quickly vanishing before our eyes. And this cycle of automation, he argues, is happening much, much more rapidly than has ever happened in the past. And these domains are retail, which we know has taken a hit for various reasons. He's predicting, or it has been predicted, and he cites up to 30% of malls will be closing within the next 4 years. That, again, it's millions of American workers. The fast food industry, fast food cooks in general, are 97% of those jobs are at risk right now. Truck drivers and freight, 79% of those jobs are at risk. That's millions of truck drivers themselves, as well as a dependent labor force, about 5 million workers who run truck stops and restaurants and motels and things that depend upon daily revenues from the trucking industry. And according to Silicon Valley, engineers are about 98% complete in automating trucking. We see Tesla and other big companies taking a crack at this. Construction labor, 88% of those jobs are apparently at risk. And call centers, which employ millions of Americans. Mail carriers, 68% of those jobs are at risk. Insurance underwriters, 99% of those jobs are at risk. And farm labor, so 97% of those are at risk. So that's just, this is Andrew Yang in his book, The War on Normal People, that he's the most recent high-profile advocate in the mainstream policy debates, and he's actually joined the 2020 race for president as a Democratic contender there, exclusively on the basis of this issue. So that's a lengthy intro and overview. Let's hear now from the experts. Perhaps in your own words, to add to some of this, what exactly is the problem from each of your points of view for which UBI is a potential solution? And I guess what we can just go ahead and start with Rudy. And
okay, I'm going to try to answer that question, but I want to go to the whiteboard and make sort of my opening pitch if I can in that.
Sure.
You know. And so, first of all, of course, thanks for having this discussion. There are lots of people in the room that I've had discussions about this issue with, and nevertheless claim no expertise. So I want to make basically two very simple points. The first one is it's actually a diagram. So we're doing economics, right? So we have here on this axis we have pre-tax income, and on this axis we have post-tax income. If you can follow my handwriting. Now, that's a line, that's a 45-degree line with a slope of 1. So every point on this line, your pre-tax income and your post-tax income is the same, so that you don't have, there is essentially no redistribution if your pre-tax and post-tax income actually, if the entire society would fall along this line. Now, if you're, that's not how our society's economies are organized. We have some tax system that distributes some income to the poorest and basically takes them from people who have some income. So the actual line might be something like this, so that there are people who have actually no market income and they still don't starve because they're getting nutritional assistance. And others might get an earned income tax credit. So there are, you know, SNAP and TANF and EITC and these kind of programs in the U.S., but other advanced countries have the equivalent programs, so that that you see that people with very low pre-tax incomes actually get some support through the transfer system. Others on the top here have are paying substantial amounts of the overall tax revenue. So this is... just a progressive tax system. Now, the question here is, and always has been, how steep or flat should this line be? And you can imagine that in the US, it's a little bit steeper, meaning that your pre- and post-tax income is a little closer together than they are in, let's say, most European countries. So that in France, this line would be a little flatter, so that your pre-tax income is there. You know, there's more redistribution here. The key question about the UBI is, so this is the first point, okay, as a framing device. The question is, of course, how does the UBI fit in here? And as long as we have markets, as long as our economies are organized around markets, we're going to have this. Income that is generated here, and the UBI is going to be financed, at least to some extent, out of taxes. And so you can use this as a framing device for the UBI discussion. The question is then whether a UBI is supposed to address poverty or inequality. I.e., here, reduce the hardship, the most extreme hardship for the poorest, or compress the income distribution and help the middle class and so on, who are not starving, or end capitalism, right? There is, as Brad has said, there are on the left, hopes connected to this that this will free people from the coercive power of the labor market and as such not only eliminate poverty and inequality or limit poverty and inequality, but actually provide a foundation for a very different society. So this, we can talk about that. One way to then connect this to the diagram is to consider this point here. This, when you have absolutely no income, when you are unable or unwilling to work, when you would prefer to be at home and do a vegetable gardening and or care for elderly relatives and such, which is obviously societally desirable, but not paid. So with a UBI, you could stay home and do these things. And the question is whether whether this point represents a living wage. And the question is how this point relates to the current point, which is basically what's provided through healthcare for the poorest, Medicare, Medicaid, and SNAP, and TANF, and EITC, right? Even though EITC is connected to work already, and other programs might not be. So that's the key question to my mind. And just to give the sort of the punchline is that there's no politically feasible path to create a UBI in current conditions that could shift this point upwards. Recall that everything that has happened since 1980 is to make this line steeper, from Reagan to Clinton to Bush and Obama, and now Trump. This has only become steeper, meaning your pre-tax income is more closely aligned to your post-tax income. So, but that's just as an opener.
Great. No, that's great. Thank you.
So, what problems would it solve? So, my perspective really is sort of from this public policy perspective, working with the programs. Your name completely just left my head.
Rudy.
Rudy. Rudy talked about, so TANF, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which used to be AFDC, Aid for Families for Dependent Children. Welfare reform happened in 1996. We'll change welfare as we know it. It's why I hate Bill Clinton, is because it was, you know, he pushed people, the most vulnerable people, further into poverty, and he didn't need to do it, but he did it for political expediency. So we don't have a really great history in this country of taking those kinds of programs and making them work. I think what it would do in sort of an idealistic world, if you could say, like, if we could pull this off and make it work, it would obviously help the folks that I work with every day, the people who are either working the kinds of jobs, working two or three jobs, that still earn too little to go off of public assistance. 86% of TANF, or I'm sorry, of SNAP households, which is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, otherwise known as food stamps, 86% of those households with a working age adult already have earned income. And so it would help those families significantly. It would help the 80-year-old lady who's, you know, trying to figure out how to move her mobile home because a mobile home park's being sold. It would help, you know, it would help that most vulnerable group. But I don't think that there's the political will to do it. I mean, what we do instead is spend a lot of time passing public policy and making programs with the assumption that everyone is starting off in the same place. And none of us are. None of us are starting off in the same place. We all have our individual needs and a different starting place. And what occurred to me as we were sort of ramping up and doing the intro, and you were talking about all the folks who are supportive of this or who are talking about it or who think it's a really great idea. And the thing that occurred to me is, where are the voices of the poor folk who this is intended for? And so I thought, okay, so who here has heard of the Poor People's Campaign? Raise your hand if you have. There is not one thing in their agenda that says they want a guaranteed income, that they want anything that looks like a universal basic income. It is about fair wages. It's about access to housing, to healthcare, to unionizing, that they want more opportunity. They don't want, you know, whether you're unwilling to work or unable to work. I think that is the group of people who would help the most. People who just don't have access to mental health care, who, because of their life circumstances, can't get and keep a job. Or maybe they can get a job, but they can't get a job that pays them enough to move out of poverty. And it's not that I'm not open to this idea. I'm a cynical optimist that we can have these ideals, but there has to be a fundamental cultural change in our country in order for something like this to work.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we air a panel discussion given on February 27th, 2019, asking the question, should we have a universal basic income? Picking up where we left off, here is economist Stephen Bannister, associate professor and lecturer at the University of Utah.
Okay, now that we've got the problem solved, right? So I'm going to make one really big point, and that is that UBI is yet another program that Brad started through a history of them going back to Tom Paine. They go back further to alleviate poverty. And you start thinking about poverty in the richest nation in the world. I mean, I think our current average per capita GDP is around $60,000+ for every man, woman, and child, roughly, right, in this country, on the average. But still, we have 14% of Americans and over 20% of children officially living in poverty in this country. So UBI is yet another attempt at that, and it goes back way into history, beyond before Tom Paine, back to the Elizabethan poor laws in the first part of the 17th century, 1601, you know, worried about the rural poor that were starting to be made poor by shutting down farms and you know, industrialization and so forth. So it's been with us. Now Brad brings up another aspect of it, which is, you know, the disappearance of jobs in the future, and I think that's still a bit speculative. There's not a lot of agreement among economists on how that's actually going to sort out. The history has always been we've been able to generate additional jobs in new categories as old ones disappeared. So we'll have to watch that. It's certainly something to keep an eye on. But as a poverty alleviation thing, I'm with the other panelists. I think it's got problems because of the things that were mentioned. And another one is that the estimates of funding a UBI range up to around, I think, 25% of GDP. GDP is about, what, $20 trillion in the U.S. this year, so that's a big chunk of money. It's $5 trillion. Where's it going to come from? Are we going to be able to raise taxes to that level to fund a UBI? Probably not anytime soon. So it feels like a good idea to do this, especially as a poverty alleviation program, but it's politically, problematic. And there are some other alternative proposals that maybe we'll have a chance to talk about, including some that are embedded in the Green New Deal program that's being mentioned quite a bit in the public discourse these days.
Great. Thank you, Steve. And actually, maybe we could even just keep going with that because of the recent Green New Deal having made headlines and being discussed. Why don't you give an overview of that?
And I haven't had time yet to really digest the Green New Deal, but I think the kind of program that addresses this problem that we're trying to fix, have been trying to fix for at least five centuries and probably much longer than that, is something that's categorized as a job guarantee program. It's interesting because it addresses some of the issues that Gina raised about poor people seem to really want a job, but one that has a living wage, not one that puts them in poverty, right? And that's, I think, the program that's embedded in there. And as it turns out, there's support for that kind of program across the political spectrum, including from people on the very progressive left, and there's a particular researcher, Pavlina Cherneva from she's at Bard College and Levy Institute, who's done quite a bit of work on this, and you know is making some progress at least intellectually on coming up with a job guarantee that basically says everybody that wants a job gets one guaranteed, and it may be a job that does things generating public goods, things that wouldn't get funded through the private sector, like we did guess what, during the Great Depression, right, when we had a lot of people unemployed and the government, FDR, put them to work. Same idea. We don't need it on that scale, but the same basic idea. And that's a lot cheaper. That's at least much cheaper in terms of GDP, 2 to 4% are some of the estimates. So that's a much more pragmatic way to think about it that addresses the desire of people to have a job as long as they're capable of doing it. And wherever that comes from, I mean, I think we've just been trained from childhood, maybe brainwashed by the system to want to work. But people do want to be busy. They want to be productive. So, and the research actually supports that. Interesting. Just one factoid, and then I'll turn it back over. In fact, I think I got this from Pavlina. But there was a research study in the 90s looking at this problem about unemployed people, and the research indicates that non-pecuniary, non-money costs of unemployment far outweigh the money costs. About 90% of the costs in this research is not associated with money. It's associated with not having a job, not being productive, and all those things, all the psychological issues. And only about 10% not having the money. So that's a bit of a surprise that people really value being working. Yes, they have to have money, but there are many other things that work brings us in the way we've been brought up in the current system.
So. Great.
I think just very briefly about jobs guarantee, which, you know, I think I mean, I don't disagree with that as long as they're not really crappy jobs, you know, that you don't just, it's not any job is better than no job, but it's a job guarantee that has dignity, that people are paid a living wage and they have access to housing and all of those other things. And I think really, you know, and I was super interested. I can't remember, he's the far right guy who said they don't want to pay people to just breed. And it, oh, breed.
Right. Arthur Brooks. No, to breed.
Yeah. Oh, that's what, oh, okay, it was breed. Oh, okay.
I'm fairly sure. I could check I'll have to check my source, but because, I'm quite sure.
So, I mean, which is, it's so debasing to people that there is this notion, and I see this every day. I just got back from Washington, D.C., and yesterday we did Hill visits with our congressional delegation. And I can tell you that there is such cynicism about these programs right now that help low-income people. And I know, it's shocking. But I think that, you know, giving each other, giving people the benefit of the doubt, that we want to be productive, that people want to have jobs with dignity, and they want to do something that helps them get out of bed every day and make the world a better place. And whatever that is, I mean, we all, you know, have something to contribute. And there's so much shame associated. I think maybe it's, you know, the cultural thing that we're so conditioned to believe that asking for help is shameful, and, you know, we have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. And, you know, I think a jobs guarantee program might help alleviate some of that there isn't shame in contributing in a way that, I don't know, you know, for lack of a better term, you're earning your keep. But people don't want to be on public assistance. You know, we see it every day. People who just are desperate to put food on the table, and it's like, okay, I need to apply for food stamps. I don't want to, but I don't know what else to do. So I think a jobs guarantee program that is that allows people to have some dignity and to get up every day and contribute would be great, but it would need a lot of work.
Yeah, I just as a quick note, the Nixon thing, the family assistance plan that Nixon thought, you know, actually to, you know, could get passed and was approved in the House and rejected in the Senate. And Nixon sort of backpedaled at the last minute. And I've read one account of this story that an advisor who was afraid that this would backfire with the conservative base, that people are, you know, would get money for nothing. That the argument of that advisor was based in Polanyi's writing. who was who himself came to a critical assessment of the poor laws and the speed and land system. And so it's a, you know, it's an ironic twist of history. But above that, Nixon was advised on this plan by Friedman, right, who was in favor of this. So there's strong support historically from the right for such a plan because it presumably can do away with all other welfare. And so you can imagine that a version of UBI instituted from the right would shift that point on the axis down, not up. And so that's the risk essentially in the current situation. Mm-hmm. But to add to the Green New Deal, I think that a jobs guarantee and the UBI suffer from the same problem, that there are questions about implementation and political feasibility, whereas a truly strong push for infrastructure, in investments in education, including places like this, and strong support for the jobs that actually exist in the economy, providing living wages. These are the kind of things that are compatible with the incentives that exist in capitalism. And it is not clear to me whether we can, you know, put mechanisms in place such as a UBI or a jobs guarantee that would fundamentally seek to weaken those mechanisms.
And we talk about incentives of capitalism. So jumping back to the automation of the trucking and freight industry, I've read statistics that the economic incentive to fully automate trucking is something like, I think it's $168 billion annually in cost savings, basically by eliminating human operators, human drivers. So that's a real incentive. And so those engineers acting very rationally who are working on that problem, that's a tough one to crack and to reverse. If that indeed is the right solution.
I can't remember. It was on NPR. I hate saying I heard stuff on NPR. But there is a drastic shortage right now of truck drivers. I mean, there aren't enough people to fill those jobs. What do I know? I mean, you know, I get paid to complain about, you know, hunger. But it seems to me that maybe there's some false equivalencies that, yeah, maybe automation is, you know, is replacing some jobs, but there are jobs right now that are currently not being filled. And so, you know, where's that gap? And, I mean, maybe automating truck driving isn't such a bad idea if there aren't enough people to take those jobs.
Right, and I think part of the issue is what types of jobs are they and at what compensation level, and is this basically, even if people are filling those types of jobs, is this a long-term solution to basically say, well, there are other jobs available if quickly, you know, retail and call centers and trucking and manufacturing and all these other entire industries are, and whether it's 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, eventually it appears that there will be major shifts happening in the economy.
So what Brad is referring to is something that Schumpeter talked about as creative destruction in any economy, where there's always technological advances that put certain people and entire sectors or industries out of work. But I'm going to repeat, for a long time, since the beginning of industrial capitalism, so we're talking several hundred years, there's always been something new that came along that generated more new jobs. And the question, the debate among economists, growth economists, development economists, is whether that trend is going to continue into the future to replace those truck drivers that are going to get automated away or not. And part of the issue is the pace of technological advance is going exponential. And so the potential for automating more and more jobs, I think that you correctly pointed to, is a bit of concern, but we haven't seen it yet, you know, and it's not clear we're going to see it. There always seems to be plenty of new jobs, so I don't, you know, and part of it is what Rudy alluded to, was just keep on running a very high-pressure economy with a lot of demand, and when there's a lot of demand, there's going to be demand for people working.
I actually, I mean, that's a thing about education and infrastructure investments is they're providing this short-run demand stimulus, but they're affecting the long-run supply conditions as well. And so you can obviously see that investing truly in an energy transition and updates to infrastructure and education is entirely compatible with, you know, the political system that we have, or possibly maybe had, in the 50s and 60s and 70s or something like that, because it's not clear what we currently have. But you know, that's a route that's probably politically feasible in some way. And I agree as well. I haven't mentioned the robots intentionally because it's just not the key issue, I think. It might be in the future, but the problem right now is that fast food workers and truck drivers and nurses and so on and so on are not able to make ends meet, not even to talk about the people who are actually poor. So what you have to figure out is how to support institutions that help those people that get the jobs that are currently available to make do with those. I think that's the task, not to imagine a automated future, which doesn't mean that it's not relevant.
Or maybe it will generate a renaissance where people, you know, will have new artists and musicians and poets. And, you know, I mean, I know that that's probably sounds silly, but, you know, we can, how many fast food workers are poets? You know, how many janitors write music? And I want to think that there's a better future for everyone, from that fast food worker to that janitor, to those childcare workers. And our political system has to care enough about those people to make that possible. And I think it is. It's a political uphill climb.
That's Gina Cornia, Executive Director of Utahns Against Hunger, on February 27th, 2019. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today we are a forum on universal basic income in the U.S.
So, and if I could just mention something to that end. So we know from, I mean, there's plenty of evidence that shows that people who are trapped in the cycle of poverty, they operate from a scarcity mindset. And that scarcity mindset can be completely debilitating. It's basically the perpetual feeling of a lack of enough of resources and basic needs. And one of the arguments in favor of UBI is essentially to help people move beyond the scarcity mindset, which keeps them perpetually in this defensive mode, by providing some level of a safety net, which would, as you mentioned, Gina, unlock creativity, more artistic creation, innovation, and more entrepreneurship is actually one of the arguments coming out of the Silicon Valley camp in support of this idea. And we've mentioned that, you know, this is just one side of it, and we haven't necessarily seen the the robots coming for the jobs yet. But to what is it, to quote the HBO show, the Flight of the Conchords, the humans are dead. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's pretty good. But essentially, it's about the automation of the future, robots coming for our jobs. But essentially, that is one of the arguments that people make, that if those currently trapped in poverty are able to just meet their basic needs, that this would actually unlock a wave of growth through entrepreneurship and creativity.
There's another fascinating piece of history regarding being replaced by robots. That idea is not new. In fact, it goes all the way back to Aristotle, who said basically that work would be replaced by automation. He didn't say it in those words, but he had that concept. Well, that's a few thousand years ago. It still hasn't happened. Frankly, my concern is not that the robots will replace the workforce, but that if the current population trends are true, we're going to run out of workers in the future, and we're going to have to do something for production, because the population will age and, you know, age out of the workforce. And that is a trend that's happening right now. So automation may indeed be a replacement for that. It's already happening in some countries, like Japan and so forth, where they're already headed down the population curve. So that's an interesting aspect of automation, to replace
I agree with that. So the future problems might actually be a labor supply and the robots. But today's problem is different, right? And you mentioned this, like UBI as a safety net. That's exactly what that diagram is supposed to illustrate, right? If it's just a safety net, why don't we talk about the safety net?
Yeah.
You know, it's like this is the thing that sort of gets me worked up. I mean, this is an old idea and an old debate. But the center-left and the left have basically gotten worn down, ground down by the inacceptability of actually discussing a benefit system and a redistributive system, a progressive tax system with transfers. We can't do that, so we're imagining a UBI that's supposed to solve all of these problems. And so I see like a rhetoric, it's a rhetorical device that helps people on the center left and left to corral around an issue. And I'm sort of all for that. But what it boils down to, if anything, is a redistributive tax and transfer system. And I think we have to be very clear about that and then just argue for benefits.
So, and it appears that on the right, a lot of the arguments against UBI take the stance that redistribution is not the answer and may perhaps be more in favor of like a negative tax. Up to, you know, you make up to $25,000 a year before you are taxed, and that seems to be more palatable.
But all of the ideas on the right that are built around this idea, they say, okay, you get $25,000, you know, up to that, but that must include your, you then must buy health insurance on the private market.
Right.
And so you're obviously poor, and you're obviously not having a living income. And so it's neither UBI nor a sufficient safety net. And so it is from the right, the proposal to dismantle the remnants of the welfare state. And that's not what anybody wants.
Except the right.
Except.
Well, and they do it under the guise of people just aren't trying hard enough.
Right.
And SNAP benefits, for example, are extraordinarily modest. In Utah, they're $1.27 per person per meal. And even though collectively Utah spends between $20 and $25 million every single month on food stamp benefits, they're still per person very modest. And I mean, there's a, you know, list as long of my arm of research that demonstrates that that isn't adequate. And it was never meant to fully cover someone's grocery bill, but more and more, that's the only money people have available to buy food because the rent is too damn high. I mean, they can't afford their housing. They can't afford transportation. They can't afford health care. And they end up going to the emergency food pantry at the end of the month to get stale bread and, you know, rotten produce to feed their families until they get their next allotment. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, I agree with Rudy that, I mean, we need to have a conversation about our current support system before we have this really, you know, very lofty idea about a UBI. Let's fix our system now and make sure that people, you know, don't live in that deficit place. I mean, just that panic and that heavy feeling in your gut when you don't know if the milk is going to last the rest of the week. You water it down, you know, you skimp on your baby's formula because you're not going to get your WIC vouchers for another week. And you can't get baby formula at emergency food pantries. And, you know, let's fix that first.
So can I ask our economists then, Steve, you mentioned that generating a bunch of demand is a potential solution to this. So one of the terms that Andrew Yang uses for this this type of a model, this UBI type of model, is trickle-up economics. So we know we've been sold. We trickle down for some time with questionable results. So this could perform, and he's also calling this UBI a freedom dividend instead of a guaranteed payment. Obviously, that's a tongue-in-cheek, but so is generating more demand a potential way out? I mean, and is it viable?
Well, it certainly has been in the past. It has been in the past, not in the recent past in this country, but absolutely yes. I mean, there's no, as long as there are unused input resources available in an economy, and that includes workers and raw materials, there is no economic reason not to try to produce useful output with that. There's no reason. I mean, it's essentially, I mean, I hate to use the word, but in macroeconomics, if you have unused resources and you put them to work, it's essentially a free lunch. You're putting stuff to work and getting output to share that you wouldn't otherwise do. So that's where I come at it. You know, you generate, and you know, the current mode of industrial capitalism has not proven capable of driving an economy to that sustained level of high output or demand over extended periods of time, certainly over the last 40 years. Well, I mean, so that's where, you know, we go back to Keynes and say, look, you know, it's time for the government to step in and do things like funding infrastructure programs and other investments in the future that generate jobs today and additional supply and goods and living standards in the future. And I think it's very feasible, except for the politics, right? It's the politics that are preventing us. From an economic standpoint, I don't think there's any question that that's eminently feasible.
How might that increased demand impact the cost of living that's already crippling to a lot of people?
Well, if you're not employing all your resources, you're not generating inflationary growth, right? So the trick is to try to run a high-pressure economy, to run at full capacity, if you will, among all resources, including the labor force, you know, drive unemployment as close to zero as possible. And then you manage everything by looking at the inflation rate. And if inflation rates start going up over an extended period of time, you back off the accelerator a bit. But you should keep it down until you start seeing inflation. That's the way I'd run the economy.
Rudy, do you have any thoughts?
I mean, yep. I agree. Just to add to it, that's the fundamental, that's the fine line to walk, that there is, that we have these targets in terms of employment and people's well-being that's connected to employment and the incomes that they earn. But you need to, as long as we're committed to running this as a market economy, you need to be committed to actually going off the accelerator or hitting on the brakes when inflation arises, because otherwise you're running the risk of endangering the system, right? So that there are lessons to be learned from history as well. And that basically means that you can't push that line too flat. There's a ways to go from where we are, but it's hard to push it too strong, probably.
Now, well, one additional thought is that in the recent past, the best anti-poverty or poverty reduction programs have been very high employment situations, like the late 90s. That, you know, 3 or 4 years in the late 90s, we were running a very hot economy for a bunch of reasons, and unemployment across the entire demographic spectrum, including people that usually have trouble getting jobs, went down, and that helped. Poverty went down, right? That's a demonstration that works if you run a hot economy.
If I'm not mistaken, Utah actually dropped below 3% at that point.
I think that's correct.
It was 2.8% or something.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. So let me ask then: Would something like a UBI plan disincentivize working? That's what we hear a lot.
Okay, so that gives me another chance to go back to the diagram. Basically, the question is if you have the, you know, if you imagine that you're increasing the tax rates on high incomes a lot, would those people stop working? Right. Would they stop being innovative? So there's the labels that we have for you know, people at the top of the income distribution. They're innovators, they're job creators, and so on. And the question is how strong that response is. And all of the research, and there's no credible research to counter these findings, is that a tax rate that is not too high averages around 70-75%.
Marginal tax rate.
The marginal tax rate, right? On the highest incomes. Right, so not across, but it's basically about that top income tax rate. The top income tax rate was by Republicans' tax reform was just reduced from something to about 35, right? From 38 to 35. So the current debate is about, are we going to have 35 or 39 or 36 or 37? Whereas the actual, the academic conclusion is very strong that it should be 75%. And that's the proposal for a top marginal tax rate that has been put on the table by various Democrats that are stirring this debate now. So we had these tax rates until 1980. They were reduced only with Reagan from 70%, and they were 90 before. And so that's the long and the short of it. There is no negative effect on labor supply. And the other question to ponder actually is whether we would be worse off if Zuckerberg would have decided not to invent Facebook, right? That's a question that is actually hard to answer.
On the other end of the scale, some of the, you know, the current experiments in UBIs around the world, the evidence has been mixed about whether it reduces the work effort. There may be some slight reduction, but not a lot. So even people on these experiments, like in Finland and so forth, they still want to work and often do work, but there's some reduction. They transfer some of their time to education and other things.
Or volunteering or other social.
My response is the favorite word of my boyfriend Joe Biden, which is malarkey. I mean, people want to work, people want to contribute, they want to get up every day and think that they're going somewhere that makes a difference. Now, you know, if it helps motivate them to go to school or to be able to stay home and raise their children, which is work, which we should value just as much as anyone else doing a job, to take care of aging parents, they're is I think maybe we need to think about redefining work and redefining a job because people want to contribute. I never talk to anybody that we're helping, and I've been doing this for 23 years. I've never talked to anybody who doesn't have another issue going on that doesn't want to work. So, you know, sort of the unwilling to work, if you're unwilling to work, you've got other stuff happening that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely. And we should point out that that Alaska, the U.S. state of Alaska, has actually paid an oil dividend to all of its residents for 36 or 37 years now. And I think that they've generated some interesting results that have been mostly positive. Now, that's just a few thousand dollars a year, from what I understand. But what are we learning from some of these other cases beyond the Finland case that is still a bit inconclusive, it sounds like. But
it is. And you know, some of the original findings, like in, I think it was it Manitoba and the Canadian experience in the 70s, they were, that appeared to be negative on the surface, but those were reevaluated more professionally and shown to be essentially no impact on work desire. So it's still in the area of questioning, but there's no clear-cut desire for people on these pilot programs to stop working. It's just not there in the data. So I mean, from that standpoint, UBIs are somewhat feasible, but the cost of them is not. So.
The other thing that has been learned from the experiments is, I think, that across the variety that has been instituted is that it's very hard to get an actual case study for a UBI, because a UBI is supposed to have no target. Right, the actual UBI means that you get money and there are no conditions attached. The actual experiments are all designed to target people that are poor or unemployed and to get them into work. So they're by definition not a study of UBI. And so there are some, you know, there's, for example, there's a German crowdfunding campaign. They, whenever they get a certain amount of money, they have a lottery, and you get the money, and you get 2,000 euros a month for, I think, a couple of years, and no strings attached, nothing. So they've given away a few of them, and their experiences are mixed, let's say, because, for example, the first thing that people do is go on a really long vacation to a beautiful island.
Longer than normal, even for Germans.
Longer than normal, even for Germans. And so, that's the thing. The it's very hard to actually design a study of a UBI because even if you have a small sample and you want to figure out what these individuals do with such a cash income, that's not the equivalent of saying everybody gets this, because then you would actually have to solve that that redistributive question. You don't have to do that in a small scale study. Mm-hmm. And so it's very problematic, you know, it's from a research design standpoint.
The Swiss were trying to pull it off. They had a non-means tested proposal that 70% of the Swiss people voted against, so it wasn't widely supported. But that would have been a great experiment, but it didn't happen. Yeah, close to 80.
Interesting. So one other question about a potential approach to this. Our current market-driven economy obviously rewards different types of value creation wildly. And it's created a lot, led to a lot of this inequality. And so I'm just curious if you think that it's some kind of a tax on, you know, the FANG companies, the Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, is that something that should be addressed, whether we're just trying to provide a greater welfare state or whether we want to move into the terrain of even discussing the viability of UBI?
Well, it certainly points to the fact that our redistributive safety net has been in a sad state of disrepair increasingly over the last 40 years. And if that gets repaired, then some of that goes away just by the design of the system, which is why we did it in the first place in the Great Depression. So that's my answer, is I think I'm with Rudy and Gina on this. Let's fix what we have right now and get it working much better, and then worry about some of these pie-in-the-sky things.
Would a value-added tax work in the U.S.?
Sure, it works everywhere in the world. So it could work here, and there may be some advantages to that.
Political will again, probably, huh? Thank you all very much. We have a few minutes left, I believe, so why don't we, 1 minute, maybe open the floor up for some questions. Hans will circulate the mic here.
Hi. Yang, 2020. So most of the discussion around UBI in every country where this debate's going on seems to kind of be centered around redistributing income and wealth within a country. What do you guys think of all the sort of nonprofits that have popped up around UBI that have sort of taken UBI into their own hands to sort of use tax-deductible donations to get UBI where it's actually, you know, affordable for the people in the world that actually need it the most?
So, for example, Y Combinator, or would you name one to get me focused? Not familiar with that one.
No.
Go ahead. I guess my only response to that, I am also not familiar with that, and I think it depends if you're talking about some of those programs that help folks in third world countries. I think that's a different matter than the U.S. But my response would be is that charity can't solve those kinds of problems because they're too big. Just for example, you know, like I mentioned, you know, in just the food stamp program, Utah spends between $20 and $25 million a month. That doesn't include WIC and a bunch of other programs. And there are only about 140 emergency food pantries across our state. So just, I don't think that charity and depending on folks' goodwill can fix it. Knowing nothing about, I mean, you know, just knowing nothing about those specific programs.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That's our time. Thanks to the panelists and for all of you.
That's Gina Cornia, Executive Director of Utahns Against Hunger, on February 27th, 2019. If you'd like to hear the full discussion or other Hinckley forums, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.